When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for
another episode of This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob.
Dr. Drew and Bob.
Yeah. So, introduce our guest.
It's Mike.
Mike Atwood.
And Bianca, his wife.
All right, so Mike Atwood, Loveline co-host, also KBC co-host. Mike, give some of your other stuff.
Also, occasional lover of Dr. Drew. No.
That was
the
only in
show.
Prison, though, right?
Originally, original.
All right, let's get
original prostate surgery.
His lovely wife Bianca is here. Bianca is the star of Undateable. And did you do my prostate surgery?
No, I was the original guy who investigated the area.
Oh, you found the tumor. Yeah. I see. Thank you.
Oh, really? You saved his life.
I was like, Drew, I'm pushing up against something here.
Stop it.
It was with his tongue. Strangely enough.
Come on.
God. All right, I got that.
When they talk about partnerships in radio, it's amazing what you guys have.
Well, it's also, it's so funny how territorial I get over Drew and our gay man love. Because it's not as bad as my wife, obviously, but it's close. You know, like when I hear like Drew's
protective.
Like, I'm going to dinner with Mike Carano. I just can't get enough of it. Oh, I can't. I just love seeing Jason. He's my man. I'm in
Jason
a relationship.
Ellis.
And Duncan Trussell's like, and I'm like, hey, I'm over here. You know, I'm in the room.
Let alone Adam.
Oh, well, that honestly is like a marriage, him and Adam.
He doesn't compete with
that. That's his first marriage. That's his first marriage. Right. They're divorced.
Well, no, not even. It's like those other guys that
you
mentioned.
We're on sex still.
I thought that I was Drew's.
He's coming by for a booty call after they got divorced.
I thought I was Drew's best mistress because Adam's his wife. And I thought, but it turns out I'm like third in line of his mistresses.
Oh, my God. Where do I rate?
You're his therapist or something. Yeah. It's purely healthy with
so
you.
So what is it like to be married to this?
Who are you talking to?
A lot of times I laugh, but I'm not really smiling inside.
Does it sometimes shock you? Like the stuff he says shocks me.
Oh, yeah.
And they do it. You've been to Love Lines, right? They do it so calmly, and they're both on the internet and on their phones,
yeah.
And they're saying the most stuff like that.
Yeah.
We met on Love Lines.
Yeah, that's
we
right.
We met on Love Lines, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was really shocking for me.
Were you texting?
No, this was pre-cell phone, pre-smartphone. It was not pre-cell phone, but it was pre.
Yeah, it was
pre, like where you had
really
internet
in
on your stuff. You
know? I find it very distracting to be on with them because they're both looking at computer screens and they're on their phones, and you're trying to talk about life and death situations with addiction.
Yeah,
Bob, you have ADD; it's a problem.
But also in that circumstance, like Drew has legit stuff he's texting about, and my husband's just looking at girls and
cars
and black
cars.
Dick.
To
black
be fair, dick. He's showing it all to me.
That's true.
I've been looking at a lot of cars lately.
So what happens when you, the first thing I wanted to talk about when you guys got on here is when you're a car enthusiast, like, and I've seen the cars and talk about the cars, I don't care about cars at all.
Yeah.
They get you from point A to point B is my opinion. If they have a satellite radio, that's all you need. What happens when you have a child?
As you're sitting right next
first,
to two guys
expense,
who work in terrestrial radio, we really appreciate it.
Thank you. We have two terrestrial radio shows. Thanks for mentioning satellite.
Listen. Let's get to the point of it. You can't be into cars and have children. I'm here to tell you and defend behind her.
I think if you have
what?
Not to sound like ivory tower guy, but if you have a certain amount of capital, I think you can. I think if you're struggling
but
to get by.
But when you're paying for $1,300 for a high-fuel injection carburetor, that $1,300 could go towards a college fund.
Yeah,
if you have fuel injection, there's no carburetor.
Okay. Well, whatever the fuck it is, it shows you what I know. You know what I'm talking about. My friend Louis is into cars. He pays $1,300 for a line to the manifold. And
I see where you're coming from, but it would
you
be.
You disagree.
No, I don't. I just think that. It's more about, it's less about, if you're a car guy and you have a car that you have to spend a lot of time on, I think that is, it's not responsible. If you're
You'd be hiding in the garage. Yeah.
But, you know, I have a 66 GTO.
I saw
and we,
it.
We came to the conclusion, it's like, I'm getting rid of it. It's just, it's not practical, you know? It was not that, I mean, it was a little but it wasn't
Here's
fully.
The thing, Mike really has been struggling with this decision because he has his, he has his motorcycle and he has his GTO. And then I have our car and then I have a 79 Jeep. And we have four cars and a motorcycle, which is ridiculous. But Mike really struggles with it because he's like gone through these cycles of I'm going to sell it. No, I'm not going to sell it. And I think the hard thing for Mike is there's so few things that bring Mike such pure joy that those are those things. And yet, obviously, with the daughter now, she is a source of pure joy for him. So it's deciding between all of these things and being responsible. And I said to him, I was like, look, if you love them and you use them, but the motorcycle, he doesn't even ride. It's been getting fixed. And there's
he has
stuff.
This puppy dog look on his
I know,
face.
Right?
I got you. There's what happens to you when you buy a lemon for a car, and then what happened to me with my motorcycle, which is dry anal rape with a sore.
What? How much are you in for? 12 grand?
No, it's not even the money. It's the unbelievable course of action that has. I bought the motorcycle. It's an old motor. It's a 68 BSA. And it was great. I got it to the point that it was running perfectly. Points are on set. Ride it around Venice a little bit, and then I have a friend of a friend who is one of the most highly regarded like aftermarket kind of customization guys for classic motorcycles, and he's like, I'd love to, you know, trick it out. If you want me to go crazy on it, I will. And I was like, dude, that'd be amazing. He has his own TV show, Cafe Racers. This guy, he's the man. And so I ride it out there, drop it off, and he is diagnosed with like I'm going to die cancer. So my bike sits in his garage for 2 years of him going, I'll get it back to you. I got to go in for chemo. And I'm stuck in the place where I can't go, hey, motherfucker, what's going on? Because he's on his deathbed.
Ugh. Working on your bike.
Yeah. At the same time, I also can't just walk down there and take it back because I've already paid the deposit on the work he's done. So it's like, demand a refund, and then it's just so every day that went by, finally he recovers by the grace of God, fixes it. I get it back to my place. I drive 40 yards and the thing stalls. And so I'm like, hey, dude, you gotta come in. So then it's the time, when are you gonna be there for me to drive a tow out there? And so it just goes back and forth, and now I'm 4 years in and I've ridden the thing 4 miles. You know, it's just such a
That's rail race.
Well, let me tell you something. Kids need to be pushed in the park, so there's not going to be a lot of motorcycle riding.
Yeah, the motorcycle is a much easier decision to make because it's not only the whether or not it's practical, it's the danger aspect. I mean, it's just not
safe.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, but anyways, that's what I've learned because I have a place in Joshua Tree still. I used to go out there every weekend, three days a week, have a kid. When they're a baby, you can still go do what you want to do. When they get to be like a year, it's going to be less unless he likes it. He liked it till about a year ago, and now he never wants to go there. And I've had to say, you know what? There's no point in having this house. I got to get rid of it. You know what I mean? Those sacrifices as a dad that you have to make.
Sure.
Because we're not the hour-by-hour sacrificers that the moms are. But you know what I'm saying? You certainly did it. You work and parent. That's what you do.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, it's
hard to indoctrinate new guys into the system.
Sure.
Really?
Yeah, they think they're going to have it all, kind of like, you know what I mean?
Well, there's a weird that happens with some new mothers too that I hear talk that they assume that the child is going to fit into their life, not vice versa. And you're like, oh, yeah. No, you're like, you don't understand. You have an idea of how much life's going to change. And then it happens. And you're like, oh, my God.
That's the perfect analogy.
That's
you
who your
think
podcast
that
the, about a little bit, huh?
Yeah. Well, I think,
this
I mean,
tell me about your podcast.
Well, I'm not doing my podcast anymore.
The podcast still exists, but you just...
Yeah, I just, honestly, there's so much going on in our lives with work, and I really had to choose the things I want to focus on, and it was becoming a thing that actually felt more detrimental to my time and energy with my daughter and with Mike and with everything else. So Ellie took it over, but it's a great podcast. It's called Atomic Moms, and it's about all levels of parenting. But the thing that I was most surprised about when... we had Magnolia, was...
No, you had her. I yes. was there, but you had her.
Is that there's nothing else in life that you have, except maybe addiction, I would say, where you're so intrinsically connected to it that no matter if you are on the opposite end of the planet, you are still
connected.
Tethered and yeah. connected. And I used to go once a year on retreat just by myself. I would go somewhere and completely disconnect. And even when I would just go on vacation, Mike and I would go on vacation, I always was able to cut off from everything else and be there. And then I remember when she was about 6 months old, we went on a weekend trip and I was on the beach and I was like, oh my, I'm never going to be by myself ever. Like I can't disconnect. I can't cut off. And that is a very overwhelming and exhausting.
Well, for modern parents, I think it is, because in our day and age, it was 17 more years of this. There was a countdown to it.
Yeah.
Now we're the new generation of parenting where it's never going to end. They're never, I don't know.
Also,
there's an
I think
enmeshment
in a
goes
different
on.
Generation where Bianca's talking about, I'll never be alone. My parents were alone all the time. And I was alone all the time. I mean, that was a different generation. It was like, you know, my father was not this guy, but Greg Fitzsimmons made this analogy, and he was very correct. Like, if you were a dad in the 70s or before, you know, even in the early 80s, like my parents.
60s,
yeah,
our dads were.
You worked. And then if you were nice enough on the weekends
if
to like
a good
play
dad,
catch with
if you're a good
kid,
dad, you saw your kid on Saturday.
Yeah, like right. and people were like, you've done your dad duty.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, the tape is totally different. There, yeah.
How much did Don Draper do?
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly.
Well,
yeah.
Look at it this way. We just said we're at Wonderland School. That's how we talk about it. We're at Wonderland School. Like fucking three of us are going. No, our kid is going there. But on opening couple of days in the kindergarten class, for 3 days, parents are welcome to stay the whole time. Oh. At a public school, on the first 2 days I went, I said, I'll do like two, I guess. Both parents of 9 of the 15 kids, the dads took off work to go to a fucking kindergarten classroom and sit there and do nothing because you want to be doing the right thing as a dad and be rewarded
as
the
dad. If you did that in 1979,
there is no reason for the dads
there.
You would go back to work and every guy there would put a cigarette butt out in your face and go, you pussy, what is wrong with you?
I don't even think the moms were there. I don't even think the moms were there in the 70s, early 70s.
No, you part of the deal was the transition from being with the child to leaving the child. And so they always there was a whole literature around it. Mom's supposed to feel the pain, you know, feel the separation, cry whatever you need to do by yourself and let the child feel the separation by him or herself. She got all upset because I was too yeah, I was ready.
You wanted to go?
She said she was dropped me off at nursery school, and she goes, okay, I'm leaving. I'm like, yep, yep. Sayonara. Yeah. She goes, no, I'm leaving. Yep, bring me a popsicle when you get back. I said something like that. I'm busy, and she went out and cried.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I always wonder, from an evolutionary standpoint, like what are we supposed to do? What did we start out doing? And obviously that changes because technology changes and everything around us.
Social norms change.
Social norms change.
Did you see the movie Babies?
No. I heard about
it.
You've
got to see it.
Yeah.
The best mother, in my opinion, is the woman in Africa. When the kid comes around and needs and nurtures and encourages and supports. But when he's just coming around being a just seeking attention or whatever, she pushes him aside. So, and it, you would be charged as a crime in the United States for what is totally thought to be appropriate parenting in Africa.
That's exactly how Bianca treats me. She'll be connected every once in a while, but when I just want some puss, you know, she'll push me aside. Just fucking get out of here.
Get the fuck away from
me. Well, that's the problem now, I think, is that we are scheduling every second of kids' lives so that there is no time for them to become independent thinkers and people, because, and especially now with like phones, Louis C.K. does that great bit about how, you know, even when you're standing in line, those times when you look at the world around you, or you kind of get to understand who you are as a person in relation to the world,
you're
stuck in these things.
You're interrupted, yeah.
Yeah, but also, you know, there's, people feel like they have to interact with their kids at all times. I mean, Mike and I, one of the things I love so much about Magnolia is she is such, like, she'll be off on her own doing something. And we were home with family and someone went over to do something. I'm like, let her be. Like, leave. She's in her own space. She doesn't need anything. She's just in the company of herself. And we're ruining that for kids, for their ability to just exist and be.
I came to that conclusion about, like, just in life, and I know that I have a very unique set of circumstances doing what I do for a living, who I have for a wife, and the whole setup is very unique for me, but I really came to the conclusion about 3 or 4 weeks ago when Bianca was filming an independent film and she was gone all day. I mean, like, call time 8 a.m. and she was gone till well after sundown, and I was just spending an entire Sunday with just, it was like really focused connection between my daughter and I. And I had like all these grandiose plans. Let's go to the Getty and let's go to, you know, and we could have done all that. And I realized very, like, an hour after Bianca left, she just wants to jump
color.
In the puddle and
oh,
cuddle
yeah.
And paint. And
how
and,
old is she?
She'll be 2 in April.
There you go.
And I realized as I was, she finally fell asleep for a nap that day. And as we just went as the day took us and had fun doing whatever, and I went for a drive because she fell asleep in the car, and I was driving around just killing time thinking, and I was like, that's kind of how I've found success in my life too. Every time I think I'm going to
make an event
the nightclub to meet a girl and I'm gonna get a relationship, nothing's ever come of it. I met Bianca totally by accident, just doing my life, but, you know, going to Loveline. Every TV show I've ever pitched where I had a blueprint and a write-up and I did a rundown for a pilot, nothing ever came of it. I got like this amazing animated show that I'm producer and star of, fully unfolding from a guy and I having a cup of coffee and just shooting the shit. It was like totally
and he came to you.
Yeah, you know, so like there is something to be said for the kind of the organic nature and the spontaneity
and
of life.
Kids are not allowed that with all this. Elvis has play dates on March 3rd. They're already arranged and emails are going back and forth. For fucking 5-year-olds, a month from now. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. And I have to go pick him up right now, too.
He's interfering with your work.
You know, kids come first, Drew. In our society, you got to put your children first.
Your brain's a lot more fully formed than mine.
Not
but,
at all.
If I had a son named Elvis, there would be no end to the amount of times I would say, Elvis has left the building.
I say it a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I would not stop. Every time he'd go somewhere, I'd be like,
well,
hey, Bianca.
I use it in all kinds of terms. When he falls asleep, I go, Elvis is now asleep. Because that's my hardest thing when he's with me, like tonight and tomorrow night. I can't get him to sleep. It's like he goes to sleep. We thought I fell asleep like Wednesday. And I fell asleep. And then I woke up like 2 hours later and he was on the iPad playing ABC Mouse. Oh boy. And I was like, how the fuck? What are you doing? It's not okay. Who's in charge here?
I ask myself that a lot.
So I got to go get him. But it's so nice to meet you. And hopefully I can do it again.
Bob
Forrest, we'll have Bob Forrest replaced by the great Shelley Spring.
Oh,
step on
my,
in,
woo-hoo.
Shelley. Oh, we'll take a break and bring Shelley.
True. Wait. No, don't take a break.
Hello.
Hey now. We'll be right back after this.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All conversations and information exchanged during participation in the This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob Forrest podcast or interaction with drdrew.com website is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction per se. Nothing on these podcasts or posted on this site supplements or supersedes the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the sites or podcasts.
Welcome back to This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob Forrest, and in for Bob Forrest, the great Shelley Sprague.
Hi.
Hey now.
Hello.
So, have you met these guys? You met Mike, obviously.
Yeah, I've known Mike for a bit, and then I just met his lovely wife, just and learning all about her and their daughter.
And Shelly is a 15-year-old now.
Oh, my God.
So maybe you can... Yeah, daughter.
Yeah.
And maybe you can... Maybe you can shed some light on the early childhood parenting.
Yes, the early childhood parenting is extremely intense. That's my daughter now. She's telling me the Orkin man is there and what should she do? But
figure it out.
Like, I'm like, ah, whatever. It's fine.
Send him to our house.
I have a question for you since we're just starting out with this. Mm-hmm. What is it like being, do you refer to yourselves as former addicts or as, you're in recovery?
I'm always an addict. You know?
You always
say
addict.
You say
I'm in recovery. That's always
depends on the situation. Yeah,
I'm not an active user. What do you think?
But when you have a child, was that a fear of yours of going through those times with your child when they discovered drugs, alcohol, the pressures of that, knowing what is coming into it genetically? I mean, how do you? I'm so curious about that because obviously we're not there yet, and I know there's a great deal of the disease on my side of the family and obviously on Mike's, and how to approach that, because kids are going to be kids and obviously it's going to be all around them.
Yeah. I'm having that, you know, really up front now because everybody's on the weed. Everybody's on the weed.
That's and good for you,
know,
man.
So everybody is around her is doing that. I'm just a very straightforward person. And when she is asking me questions, I'm just being honest. And so she knows that genetically her predisposed Icelandic, Irish, Scottish.
You're like the perfect recipe.
Yes. She is very predisposed. Now, her personality, when I look at her personality, she probably isn't very as nearly as adventurous as I was.
Yeah.
So she's a little cautious. So I talk to her in terms that she has been able to understand all up through her childhood. And now she's 15. And now it's like, I'm sorry, you can't be around people who smoke weed. That's just not going to happen. And you cannot experiment with weed. You cannot experiment with alcohol until you are older because you cannot do this to your brain right now. And I'm very scientific about it.
Yeah.
And I just tell her, this is your time in your brain where you are developing your early adulthood. You cannot risk that by doing all of these things. And she understands. She's very bright. She completely understands. She learned how to clap in Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, so she gets it. She knows that mom doesn't, that dad doesn't, and we don't.
I would add to that, again, you need a super clear message for a teenager. It's not, well, you can just do it here, but not here. You can do it in our house, but not. No. Clarity.
No.
Simple.
Here's the rules.
And I always distill it down to, hey, I don't allow. Do I allow any other illegal activities in my house?
Right.
Is there anything else illegal I allow you to do? Well, this is not. Will not be
this
allowed
is
either.
The same.
It's illegal for you to drink, for you to smoke pot.
Right.
And I will bring the force of. If I find that you're breaking the law, I will allow the law to have at you, and I will not bail you out.
Have you been really open with her about your experiences, or?
Well, my experiences are kind of. I'm like kind of out there.
Yeah.
You know, which was a fear. You know, of people that I knew that, you know, you're going on television. You're talking about this. You're talking about your history. You know, how do you, are you worried about that? And between me and my daughter, we are very upfront and direct with each other. We have a very open line of communication. She talks to me about sex. She talks to me about boys. She talks to me about grades. She talks to me about teachers. She talks to me about what she's doing. So we have a very open dialogue, and I raised her in such a way that I gave her the information she was asking for.
Yeah.
And I didn't push it on her, but when she had a question, I sat down and I answered it in the best of my ability for her development.
And then at the end of it, that's the best way to approach whatever the topic is, or always toss out, do you ever have any questions about, or open-ended questions? And at the end, did I answer your question? Do you have any more? Did that make sense to you? Not, and oh, by the way, here comes your plumbing lesson or whatever else it is you want them to know. Don't
right,
do it.
Right.
Don't do it.
I think that was the big failure of, you know, certainly when I was growing up, the campaign to avoid or to prevent kids from getting into drugs was that it was filled with misinformation, and it was
completely
not the information they gave you was erroneous, and also they were refusing to give any. It was the just say no.
Yes.
But kids are way more curious and intuitive than people think, and they go, but why?
What does that mean?
And if you just were to say, well, if you smoke weed before a certain age, it's going to damage your brain, and it'll help. It stunts
it
development.
It will wire your brain and to need weed to function.
I either got no information or I got like the DARE
bad
program.
Information.
The DARE program where they're like, if you do cocaine,
you
immediately will be licking assholes for 50 cents in an alley. You're like, well, wait a second.
Mike's like, I'm in.
Where do I sign up?
It's so crazy because you saying that, Mike, I think about... I had a really bad experience on ecstasy when I was in college. And thankfully, I think that experience prevented me from, when I moved to LA, doing it. I was terrified because it was the first time I realized it was a terrible mix of things. And I totally freaked out.
Yeah.
And was running down a street in Pullman, Washington, where I went to college. And I remember thinking, number one, I'm dying. I'm definitely dying. Mm-hmm. And number two was, oh, my God, when my parents come to identify the body, they'll know that I did drugs. That was
those were your two thoughts.
But right. But what's crazy is that I think now, like, I had no idea what I was taking. I just my friends were like, this is ecstasy. Everybody does it. It's a lot of fun. Like, there was no... Like, by the way, this could totally fuck up your head.
Could be, yeah.
And it did. It was a catalyst for a major anxiety disorder, and I started having panic attacks and all.
Of course.
And
we see a lot of that.
Big
stuff.
Deal.
Yeah,
that's a big deal.
And from pot too.
I had no idea that my brain could work independent of me. That it could.
Right.
That it could freak me out like
people
that.
Still.
I
have
didn't know
with that.
Any of that stuff. Yeah. I had no education, so I talked to Ivy about the brain. I went to her middle school for all the health classes and did a mini brain lecture that they could understand at that level of development. And you would be so surprised. These kids are asking me about crocodile. They're asking me about stuff in, you know, because they're so exposed. Yeah. They learn about everything and they have all these questions about what's this drug and what's that drug and what does this do and what does that do? And here's the scariest question I get. Well, my dad drinks every day.
Right.
Is he an alcoholic? That was the scariest question. It was like, well, I don't know. I don't know your father. I have no idea. But I can say that maybe you could ask him a question about it. Yeah. That's all I could say.
And ask about his parents. Did they have alcohol?
Did they have it? And I just approach it as purely scientific. And I really think that my daughter, because of what I've become, she respects the fact that I'm honest with her. And that I don't try to pretend I'm somebody else, and that I don't try to you know, make up stories about how I was a great teenager and all of that stuff. I just don't. I just tell her, no, it's a nightmare. Go ask my mom.
Now, you have two different stories. I mean, that's Shelley's as the mom version. Mm-hmm. I think everything she did was exactly right. I think he should talk about it in the context and take to meetings and that kind of thing. I think participating in the recovery, I think, is a good thing. Yeah, I think seeing
definitely.
It and stuff. And not at 2, but maybe at 11 or 12.
Exactly. I mean, Ivy pre-pubic. Knows what drug addiction is. She knows that drugs aren't necessarily bad for everyone, but to become addicted to them is very, very
and
serious.
And here's the consequence.
Yeah.
Here's what
very
happened.
Very serious.
But you have a different challenge, which is the straight parent, or the so-called straight parent, shouldn't answer any questions.
Because
everything you did... If you describe it to your kid, is issuing a license to start again right there.
That's interesting.
Whatever you did, the ecstasy in college, I'll start right there. The pot in high school, whatever, I'll start right there. So what? Never ever don't, yeah. Don't ever lie to your kids.
Right.
But always say, we're not going to discuss what I did or didn't do. Here's what I expect from you. And you saw what happened to your dad. So naturally I have concerns.
Right.
So that's it. Now, when they're adult, fine. Talk about it.
Yeah.
But in adolescence, no. No, we have expectations. Because I've seen it a billion times.
Yeah.
The parents go, hey, man. I'm your buddy, man. I'm your chummy. I'm your chummy dad. Yeah. I smoked pot when I was in the ninth grade.
I get it.
I got panic attacks. Yeah. I get you. I experiment.
That is what they're going to take away from that. It doesn't mean they're doing that, but that's the takeaway.
Right.
And with my daughter, you know, I didn't raise her like a lot of the things you were talking about earlier on the show about overscheduling and about overdoing and having, you know, being a helicopter parent. I just didn't feel... My child just didn't really need that after her first 5 years that I did attachment parenting and I really bonded with her. Then she was able to, you know, I had to go away and let her move forward. And that worked. It really worked. She is independent.
But that's part of the attachment mechanism. It's called rapprochement. You ever heard of this?
No.
It's actually one of the more delicate parts of parenting, which is the going and coming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much do you bring them in? How much do you push them out?
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're dealing with now with young adults. And when the main thing is they're in control. It's like, think of them at a playground. They go out, they play. Mommy, look at me. That's connection back.
Yeah.
And they come back. Did you see what I did? You give the connection. Mm-hmm. They go back out after refueling. It's like a jet, like a plane that's going out, coming back for refueling, coming back. But they still might want you some connection at a distance, and then that distance gets more.
Yeah, and then
and
when they're 15, they're so unimpressed with you. Yeah. They are not happy to see you. They are bored with everything that you have said that you do say. They are not impressed with you whatsoever, and you have to beg them to come out of their room.
And I
did attachment parenting for 5 years.
I think, too, there's a added layer of not only taking a step back, but you also have to take a step back while at the same time encouraging them to go be independent.
That's the pushing part.
As opposed to taking a step back and letting them isolate. You know, it's like, I'm taking a step back so that you could develop your own personality and your own ideals and all, not taking a step back so that you can vegetate. You know, that's
in my hippy dippy ways, one of the greatest lessons I think I've learned so far is we also have been practicing attachment parenting for the most part. And we co-slept with Magnolia.
Uh-huh.
And then it got to a point, my whole approach to everything is like, when it's affecting us, then it's affecting her.
Okay.
So if we're
miserable
sleeping and we're not getting sleep and it's making us shitty parents during the day, then that's no longer the what we're going to do. So we finally, it got to the point where we weren't getting any sleep because she was realizing, she was finally, she would go to sleep in her bed for the first couple hours and then she would wake up for a feed and she would come in and feed and fall asleep and we'd all sleep together.
Right.
No longer working. So we decided it's time to sleep train. We met with a sleep trainer and, she said, you know, we can do this several different ways. And I was not cool with anything that involved leaving her in the room to cry because to me, I was like, she's been in the bed with us. I can't do that.
Right.
So we did this whole thing where we put her in the bed and we would sit on the floor next to the crib until she would fall asleep.
Right.
And that actually worked brilliantly. And she got it the first night within 15 minutes. And that was kind of the end of the story. But what started happening was she's so smart and she would slowly lure us and pull us back in. So it'd be a couple months of great. Right. And then suddenly we realized, wait, I've been in the bedroom for an hour singing You Are My Sunshine. What happened?
Yes.
And I spoke with the woman who helped us and she said, do you believe that you have the capacity, the same capacity to love your child whether you are holding her in your arms or you are in the other room? And I said, absolutely. And she said, you need to trust that that love goes beyond physical touch and that you can hold the space for them and still have that energetic connection to them, even in another room. And I really had a hard time with that at first, but I've come to understand how true that is. And it's really helped me in that I don't need to be hovering over her. I don't need to have her in my arms every moment of the day for her to feel connected to me.
Right.
When you say you had trouble with it, what was the problem?
I just didn't trust that that was possible, that she would feel my love without me standing over her and holding her and touching her. I felt like I had to be...
Well, she also doesn't make it easy.
She like, you'll be in the other room. She's like, mama, mama, I need you. Mama, mama. Like, your heart breaks. I got it easy. I was like, oh, she's calling for you.
Well, I do understand the sleep training. My daughter was born with a heart defect, and she had open heart surgery at birth.
Oh, my gosh.
She was in, you know, Cedars-Sinai intensive care unit, PICU, NICU. We slept at the hospital for a month. So when she got home, we were all traumatized.
Yeah.
So what we had to figure out was how to do this. Now, she was no thriving. She needed medication every 12 hours. She had doctor's appointments constantly. So we had a really rough beginning. And had we didn't, you know, have to go through that, I think the sleep training would have been, would have worked. But again, it's like, it's so different for each child. And Ivy could not tolerate being in a crib. She never slept in a crib. She couldn't tolerate it. She couldn't tolerate not being near me for 5 years. I mean, it was a long time. But I hung in there, and it worked out. Yeah. I'm just going to tell you, like, it'll work out somehow. Like, when she's motivated to sleep on her own, then she'll be motivated to sleep on her own. Sometimes she comes and sleeps with me now, but I know that sleep training part, she would get so upset that she would start throwing up.
Yeah.
And that was, so it just wasn't for her. You know what I mean? Wasn't something she could tolerate.
It almost sounds like you guys had major catch up to do, because she didn't get that constant contact that we normally get for that first month.
I couldn't even hold her for 5 days.
Yeah.
5 days she was intubated on tubes. I didn't get to bond with her. We had to teach her how to eat. We had to teach her how to, you know, she was just in an incubator the whole time, you know.
It's like an extended womb.
It was an extended, it was, and then it was extended period of problems, you know. So it was different. So we're very connected in a different way.
Yeah.
So she's kind of special like that in that way. So my parenting style probably, you know, wouldn't work for many people, except with multiple children. I don't even know. I couldn't even child.
Susan wanted to talk about
Susan. Yeah.
Multiple all at once.
Oh my gosh. I get an anxiety attack thinking about this. Do you want to talk about it?
Take a break and bring her in.
Okay. So
welcome back to This Life with Dr. Bob Forrest. Our guests are my Kathy Wood, my co-host on Loveline at KBC Midday Live, Bianca Kylik from Undateable, and Shelley Sprague. No, Shelley, I was going to put her on my mic. Shelley's running away.
No,
I want the moms all in there.
I was going to say,
okay, well, we can do that.
We can share a mic, Bianca.
We can share a mic.
Musical.
Shelley, come here. Okay.
I'll be right back.
Well, you know, I'm really excited to get to be on the show. Thanks for having me. It's hard for me to stay quiet in the background. It's really difficult.
Well, especially when we're talking about parenting, because you're like the queen mother. Kids at once.
Yeah.
Honestly,
I was actually writing copy for Drew to talk about at the end of the show, and I wasn't really focusing on your conversation. So sleep deprivation was like 2 years of no sleep, literally.
Right.
Didn't know what it meant until I woke up one day and I had sleep after 2 years. And that was because Douglas had brain surgery when he was 13 months.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so he had that arachnoid cyst, and I had to go into the hospital with him. And that was a really strange time for me because I had to separate from the other two.
Right.
And, you know, because we were all a unit, and then all of a sudden mom was gone. And then they brought the other two to the hospital to see me. And it was almost like they didn't recognize me, or like I was an alien to them after like a week. Because you have to sleep in the hospital with the baby for the week, and then you have to be there like round the clock. And, you know, it was sort of like life before
the surgery.
Before that, the surgery and life after. Like, I turned into the mother at that point in my life. Like, I hadn't really focused on it. It was only like a year into triplets, but it was so crazy. And we were just juggling so much. But his sleep problems were bad because he was having a problem with his brain and we didn't know it for the first year. And then he would wake up in the middle of the night and he'd wake me up and then I wanted to kill him. Right. And I asked our friend Larry Johnson, I said, what does it mean if I want to kill my child? And so next thing you know, I was on Prozac.
Right? Postpartum.
Because I did want to kill him. Right. I was like, I have to sleep and stop crying in the middle of the night because he would spit out his sucky and then we would pass fire. Mm-hmm. And I went to the doctor and I got, you know, the Willful Child book they gave me to read and, and I did everything by the book, but it helped a little bit, but it wasn't quite it. But right. be that as it may, I was struggling with everything and just trying to keep them on some kind of a schedule so I wouldn't lose my mind.
Yeah. I mean, how do you need help? Do you have to enlist
people? We had people around the clock.
You need a team.
No, we need, we had around the clock help. We had, I mean, I still have Delmi and Teresa working for me today.
Okay.
Like now Delmi's my personal assistant, but now she's actually over taking care of Drew's 91-year-old mother instead. Oh. She's great with kids. She's been with me forever. And I found her at about age 4. Teresa was here. She was my housekeeper and she was here since before they were born. And then we also had, we had another nanny. Well, at the beginning, you know, you have to have, I had to get
I'm actually
sleep.
Curious. Was the brain surgery what made Douglas such a giant pussy?
Yeah. He goes, the other day he said, you know, Mom, I wish I hadn't done football. You know, I wish I had just been doing music and whatever. And I said, yeah, but you'd be, you know, a huge pussy. I did say it to him. So, no, there was no sleep for 2 years. It was just, but we, at the beginning, we had a schedule. We had to time everything. We had to put everything on charts. It's like having patients, you know.
Right.
You know, they had to get fed.
That makes sense.
This one had a bottle. That one had a bottle.
Treatment
that one had
plan.
Yeah. It was like, and I read that in some triplet book, you know, you got to get all these charts. And they had these like pre-made charts you could order on the internet. And I, you know, I would like check off when we get a bottle because we couldn't keep track. We had 30 bottles in the refrigerator.
Oh my gosh.
We had 30 diapers in the diaper pail a day.
Yeah.
And it was like,
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Well, that's Shelly and Bianca, mostly, I mean, I was chiming in. We're talking about how you got to kind of throw out the notion of scheduling to let kids grow up. But when you have triplets, that's not an option.
No,
that's
and it not was an really option. Bad because we were helicopter parents. I could be considered a tiger mom, actually. So I, you know, we had the piano lesson, then we had the skating lesson. We had the, but, you know, I had to keep them busy because they would drive me crazy if I didn't.
Sure.
And
that makes sense.
And there wasn't a lot of, I mean, they went to school, they came home and studied, they did their nightly routines. We had dinner together every night for dinner. And we had, you know, we'd all meet at a certain time. We'd all go to each other's events. But, you know, looking back, I mean, maybe Drew Douglas was right. He shouldn't have played football. And I wanted him to play baseball, but he had to play football.
Well.
But they all would have turned out fine if we hadn't given him such a huge routine. I mean, Paulina probably wouldn't have an eating disorder either because figure skating was like, is the worst.
It's right underneath modeling is like the most.
And we didn't expect
it. Ballet. I was ballet. Yeah.
We totally did not expect it though. It was so weird. Like we were all like, what? But, you know, it happened and she's worked through it. She's had a lot of therapy and
you guys have the treatment available. That's the number one thing.
She did it herself. She went, she got checked herself in and the beauty of college is that your tuition, if you buy the insurance, when you get your college tuition, everything's covered.
Oh,
so
right.
Therapy was covered for 4 years.
Oh my gosh.
And then when she quit, I got the bills. So trust me, it's like, oh.
My daughter asked me to go to therapy and I was like, okay, let's put you right in.
No, and I don't have any problem with that. I wish Douglas had done it in college but he was so busy and he was just focusing on so many things. But, you know, he has a little PTSD thing going on. Yeah.
His whole thing is just because he's so creative. I mean,
he's super creative.
He's different than the other.
And he's driven kids, he just wants to be that thing that he wants to be. And he's doing fine. I mean, they're great. I mean, he's
if you're in the
creating
arts,
music and.
Yeah. If you go into the arts or any type of endeavor that, you know, like the entertainment industry, you could say, it's very unsatisfying to be in your early 20s.
Yes.
You know, unless you're Justin Bieber, because your friends who are accounting majors or going to law school or going to medical school or are doing all these things that are kind of a little bit more structured and planned out, it makes you day by day by day, regardless of how much hunger you have for your given field or your passion, you get stir crazy and you start to think like, right. I'm going to be 30 before I know it and I'm going to be jobless.
Also, it's so frustrating because, you know, most people I think start out going into the arts, whether it be music, because they really are artists and they want to create. Yes. And it's such a business.
He is a musician. Yeah. He was born a musician. Mm-hmm. He has the genetics of a musician. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like Jordan is a mathematician. He got the math gene. And then mm-hmm. Douglas got the ability to play music and sing music and just create it. I mean, like no other in the family.
Yeah.
So he's doing that. He's doing what he loves. But, you know, I had to force him through it. You know, I had to make sure mm-hmm. he kept doing those piano lessons. I said, I was a tiger mom. I was like, no, you're not quitting. Uh-huh. And I mean, it was like, go back to the piano.
Very Chinese of you.
Well, Ivy goes to the school for the arts. We started a charter school, Los Feliz Charter School for the Arts over here. And I was a founding parent of that school. So we really believe in the arts, and Ivy was able to basically go to a charter school that was all around the arts, music, and so now she's, you know, she's doing performing. She loves to do all of these things, and she stopped piano and moved to the guitar. So now we're in rock and roll.
Oh, good. Mm-hmm. Well, as long as she loves it and she was willing to area. Put the time in, you know, and it's,
she is, yeah.
I mean, he comes home, he plays probably piano like maybe 2 or 3 hours a day here, and then, mm-hmm. but you know, with his brain injury that he had, yes. he needed, you know, like extra time on tests. It was a little harder for him. He had to really focus. But the one thing when he would get depressed or like frustrated with whatever was going on in his life, because he was also habitually hurting himself and getting hurt and injured in sports. Mm-hmm, so he was right. like always that kid that mm-hmm. like the other three never had surgery. Other two never had surgery. And mm-hmm. he had
that.
Always the one, yeah. you know, getting hurt. And he has a little trauma there, sure. but the piano and the music would just bring him back and center him. And that's mm-hmm. just what he loves to do. Mm-hmm. Now, if he turns into a huge success one day, I don't know if it'll happen, but right now he's enjoying it. So,
and happy kids,
but it's a hard business.
Happy kids are the best kids.
Yeah,
the happy kids.
No, my kids are all great. They're all happy and
happy kids.
But you know, those first few years, the first 2 years were just a nightmare.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine because mm-hmm. mm-hmm. I mean, I for the first time this past week told Mike, I said on Thursday, it's like, today was the first day that I had the thought I could imagine having another kid. And we have one.
Uh-huh. Right.
Is it?
We even thought about it.
Oh, my goodness. After three.
They were like, no way. They were like 6 months old, and they were all laying on the bed, and they were so cute. We were like, oh. And I said, I'm only going to have a baby once. Like, I don't get to go through the baby again. And we went, oh. And then they all started crying at the same time. We were like, no. And I don't want three either. Yeah. If this ever happened to me, I wouldn't wish this on my
That's
best enemy.
That sounds so it was challenging.
So I honestly can't even wrap my head around the idea of three at one time.
Me neither. I mean, God. I wouldn't have made it. I mean, I don't know how you guys made it. I really don't. I would have lost my mind.
I mean, I think that we talked about this when you did our podcast, that part of it is that when you don't know any different, you don't have anything to compare it to, and mm-hmm. that doesn't make it in any way, shape, or form easy, but at least you're just in the mentality of, I just have to do this.
It was a science project. I mean, I had so many needles at the beginning. I worked mm-hmm. so hard to get pregnant. I really wanted to be pregnant. I wanted kids. It was just one of those things. People don't. I wanted kids. And when three came along, I just said, okay, I'm just going to have to do this. And the 9 months were hell, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me, you know, because I would be a complete loser and narcissist now if I didn't have those kids.
Have the children?
Because they've taught me so much. And
that's so amazing.
And Drew's taught me so much. And I mean, I've evolved a lot since, you know, Drew can probably attest to this, but I was like a bikini model from K-Rock. So, you know, it was a lot different then. but it was just such a challenge, but it was also like the most important thing that's ever happened in my life.
As far as
I
IQ
would agree,
average,
yeah.
though,
short of meeting Drew, of course.
As far as IQ average, though, bikini model from K-Rock ranks higher than on-air personality. I can tell you that.
I was more
a little bit higher. Yeah, it's a little higher. Right. But the things that your children teach you,
that you can't learn any other way.
Yeah. And this Christmas was amazing because I always had like this dream and this vision of one day sitting at Christmas dinner and having my kids drive the conversation. Like, you know, they weren't at the kids' table anymore.
Sure.
This was the year I felt like they were the most interesting people to listen to, and they all had a great conversation and it went beyond whatever I could ever talk about. But that was sort of that's such a great feeling, you know, when they're adults and they,
you gotta go into it though. I think you gotta be at the right place in your life. Cause I so desperately wanted kids all my life, all my adult life. Even as a kid, I wanted kids, but I knew I'd wait till I got to the right age. And during my 20s and during my first marriage, I just so desperate every day. I thought, you know, this is going to be after all the years of therapy, after sobriety, after all the things I've done to try to pull myself out of this funk. I'll have a kid and that'll make me better. And I'm so lucky that I finally had a child at a point in my life where I wasn't looking for some like lifesaver. Mm-hmm. I wanted to have a child because I wanted
it was the right
to have
time.
A child. You know, it wasn't.
Yeah, because it could be a disaster if it's at the wrong time.
Sure.
You know.
Well, and even
we'll ask my parents.
Even what I thought was so interesting about our experience having Magnolia was that, you know, leading up to the birth, everyone that I worked with, from my midwife to the doula, you know, were always like wanting to know, what trauma do I have in the past? What, you know, is there any sexual abuse or anything that could come up, you know, because a lot of times they see that right after the birth.
What trauma do you have, Bianca? And she said, have you met my husband?
But you know, what's so crazy is they didn't ask Mike any of that. Mm-hmm. And about 3 days postpartum, Mike disappeared. And I don't mean like physically, like he mentally disappeared. And when we went in to talk to our midwife, and we'd gotten some help, and we, you know, thankfully had a great person that was able to talk to him and realize like this was bringing up, the birth brought up all of his old stuff. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, we're so glad that you guys are telling us about this, because what it makes us realize is we need to talk to the dads too. It can't just be about the mom. Mm-hmm. Because it was Mike. Mike
absolutely
went through it.
We're so happy, sir, that you're such a disaster that you brought this to our attention.
We now know a new treatment model based on
it was
Mike.
It was essentially, I'll never forget. I hate to put my poor dad out like this, but, we were in Europe and we were at dinner. It was just my father and I, and we were at this unbelievable restaurant. My dad's big, like he's real dorky for the culinary arts. We were at this just like Michelin rated restaurant, and they brought out the like one of the courses, and it was this lamb chop, and it was a fucking unbelievable. And my dad just like threw it in his face and inhaled it, you know, at this place where people are accustomed to taking their time with. And no waiter asked anything, or even they just looked over and brought him another one. And I said, you understand what just happened, Dad? Like they were bumping elbows watching us, and they said, ah, this man's a disgusting pig. Let us make sure that he doesn't have any space on his plate. Let's just bring him another one without even asking.
So that's where you got it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess. Oh, my parents in their own separate ways fed me gluttony, you know, like the idea of pushing the envelope, you know, like when Shelley was saying, you know, my daughter's not as adventurous as I was. That's the thing that I see in all my friends that grew up to be addicts and me. And is it like stuff that really terrifies me just keeps drawing me back.
Want to do it.
I that feeling you get in the pit of your stomach, like when you're going down the part of the roller coaster that makes you go, like that feeling when you confront something that does that to me, I love it. Mm-hmm. I hate it in the moment, but at the same time, like I'm almost,
it just draws you back.
I'm like sexually aroused by it. I just like the idea of being on that edge. And that is the common thread. All the kids that like, you know, we would be lighting fireworks when we were little, and there was half of the kids were like, we should probably leave. And then there was four or five of us that are like,
oh no.
Oh, your dad has guns?
Oh.
Where are they at? You know, and like some of the kids were like, dude, that's insane. I'm going to leave this house right now. You're going to bring out fire.
It's such a dude thing. Yeah. You know, it's like so funny.
But wait, so that's the dopamine, right? That's yes, the going exactly. to the place of I need mm-hmm. something that is stimulating that part for me.
But we have such a large capacity for dopamine, I think, with these brains, how what makes us excited makes other people angry, terrified, uncomfortable, all of these different things. But for us, it makes us alive. Yeah. And that's the difference. And I was literally leaving the house in my diapers, like, what's going on across the street? Like, what's happening down the street? Because whatever's happening here is boring. And I was literally on the go. Literally.
So that's just like you came into this world with that. That was absolutely. Already there. Yeah.
Absolutely. I came in and I was like ready to live.
Does Magnolia have those personality yes. traits?
She does, but she still is very connected. Like it's I'm going to go, but I'm also going to make sure hand, you've got my hand. So it's she wants to go and do it, but she was always, like we were talking about earlier, checking back in.
Right. Mm-hmm. Douglas and Paulina kind of had it too, and we were always watching them, but they're fine. Mm-hmm. They don't have it.
But it's yeah. the two of your kids that are more creative.
Yeah, they were. I mean, they had like a lot of energy, and I worried about Douglas a lot more, and he's... You know, because he was kind of fidgety and up, you know, got hurt all the time too. It's just, mm-hmm. you know, and then he went through, he had to take painkillers and he had to, sure. but he was really careful. So, yeah.
But I think that that what you guys are doing with this informed way of being, and I'm sure you guys were really informed as parents as well, is that information that I didn't get.
Yes.
I didn't get.
Well, Drew has the same philosophy of before a certain age, if you do it, it's 10 times worse. So wait yes. till you're older to try it.
And absolutely.
They didn't drink. I don't think my daughter drank until she was like 18.
That's exactly what I'm looking for. Push it out. Get that brain already well, working said, good.
Now she and loves to drink, but
okay. Yeah, but I worry about that on a grand scale too, not even just drugs and alcohol and stuff that affects my daughter directly. I'm wondering, like, when's the age when I let her know about just bad stuff, period? You know, I struggle with that because I'll be watching. I'm constantly trying to watch the news and read the paper and all these things. And she wants to know what I'm doing all the time. She's like, what are you doing? What doing, Papa? And, you know, one clear example was we were down in, like, the San Diego area, way out in the desert, though, watching Bianca's brother. He had a race. So we went down to support him, and I was in the hotel room, and it was the weekend of the parachuting. And so I'm watching like this nonstop feed of all the updates on the parachute, and they're showing video of some of the shooters running. And she's like, what's this? And I struggle with, like, well, what do I say? I mean, do I let her know that there's that level of evil? Do I talk about people being murdered, or do I just make something up? I mean, neither doesn't sound exactly helping.
Age.
You know, yeah. like lying to your daughter doesn't mean, it's just people hugging each other doesn't sound very healthy. But at the same time saying, oh, well, someone decided to put a bomb off where other people were for no reason.
I used to make up stories. Mm-hmm. And then later mm-hmm. my kids would go, we can't believe how many stories you made up for us. Like you, you're totally, we can't believe you anymore. Like yeah. what else?
Yeah. Well, and I think the thing is that
they figured out later. So
it's not. I don't think it's, and obviously not at this age or not at young ages, but when they are old enough to know about that, it's not the knowing of something, not the knowing of violence or not the knowing of something, you know, that goes down that's scary. It's the repetition of that thing. So it's like if you see something and you see a news bit on it or you hear people talking about it, that's okay. You can talk about it, process it. It's when it's in our faces 24/7. Mike loves to watch murder porn, I call it, but the investigative discovery.
Too.
Yeah, well, it makes a lot of sense.
Lock up raw.
Yes, all.
Well, I think you watch it for a different reason, Shelley. I think you're sitting there
all
with
right,
your magic
all
wand.
Right, all right.
Oh, look at that cholo! Uh-huh. I think he's got tattoos on his neck. Oh,
oh, geez. I think this education system that you use will guide you when they're a certain age, like when they're in school. Because she's not in school yet, so you're still doing this by yourself. But we would follow the direction of what the other parents were doing and what the families were doing and not whip the kids into a frenzy when something tragic happens.
Yeah.
And then they would tell us how to deal with the kids and not make them scared and be, you know, you have to censor it to a certain point. Some people don't even let their kids watch TV in school. Like you're going to meet those people And they're like, my kids don't watch TV. We just can't, you know, raise them in that kind of environment. And I'm like, well, my husband works in TV, so I don't have a choice. And I love TV. So
it's just, let's get serious.
Yeah. So we very, you know, you have to be very careful, and because you don't want your kid being the one informing some other kid and then causing a big chain of events where, oh, well, I heard it from, you know,
so-and-so.
Yeah. And I don't, we always were really careful with, I think, I mean, we were pretty careful with that stuff, right, Drew?
With news events?
Yeah.
I'm in favor of being, again, always on their terms, which is kind of difficult, but being honest about stuff. Because I remember during the Watts riots, I was what?
LA riots.
The Watts riots.
Oh,
I mean, I'm going back to when I was a child.
I thought you were talking about your kids.
Yeah. I will talk about that in a second, but I remember going to my cousin's house. I was like 5 years old, and the TV was on, and they were like, "What is going on?" I go, "Oh, it's the riots." Or, you know, it's this, and I knew the whole story. I knew everything that was wrong about it, why it was happening. And my aunt and uncle pulled me aside. That we're not letting them see that. Don't. I thought,
well, that's their choice.
Yeah. I understand, but I was 5 years old. And I thought, why? That's bizarre.
Well,
you don't trust them to understand the world they live in. I'm fine, and it was bizarre.
Yeah, but you have an old soul, Drew. My parents said, "Oh, those are bad people. Don't watch it." I remember that comment.
I wouldn't tell them that either.
Which
wasn't
good.
Yeah,
but don't you think there's a difference too between what it was then, where it's like you had the news story,
it's
bombarding. You can go online and find everybody's eyewitness videos of what went down.
Right.
I mean, I've done that where something happened. I realized the next 24 hours, I'm in a spiral of just staring at the internet, reading everything that everybody has to say.
The internet is a different matter. That's a much tougher deal.
I find too, though, that what becomes normalized, sometimes it's not okay for it to become normalized. I mean, I was telling Drew the other day on HLN that the reason I never was interested in making a murderer was because it's like, oh, it's poor, uneducated people not getting good legal defense.
Mm-hmm.
What's
sad.
New?
Sad.
That's America. I mean, I found no interest. I was like, what is compelling? Because that's life.
That's,
you know, to me,
happening,
it was like
everywhere.
That was something that's gone on and has been inundated in front of my eyes since I was a little boy. It was. I've always been told that story. It's like, you know, there's the have and the have nots, and that's, it's never more clear than in a court of law, and just never. So you wonder, like, I was thinking about how so much more because of 24-hour news and because of the internet, there's people who talk negatively about politicians. And of course, it's your right, and I encourage it to show dissent when you believe it, you're an American. But never before has it been broadcast to us at such an alarming rate. And until I was in high school, you didn't hear people call the president a scumbag, or, you know, you know what I'm saying? Because, like, I was a little kid, and so the only news I got was local television news. Now, every little kid is going to grow up thinking that it's perfectly okay to say that Hillary Clinton's a murderer, or that President Obama's a traitor and a Muslim and not born in this country. And that's not really okay. Of course, is it okay to disagree with the president and have political views that are subversive? Oh, I encourage it. But the notion that you can just talk down about people has become commonplace.
Well, do you let your daughter watch South Park?
Not yet. Not.
Not
I had
really.
To suffer through South
but
Park for
Beavis
many
and
years.
I do.
What?
Beavis and Butthead. I do.
But I think, like, you hit on a good point. I don't think it's just about, like, the president or you know, people of great stature. It's the fact that kids today think it's okay to go on social media and write horrible things that they would never say to somebody's face, to
horrible.
Somebody that they don't even know.
Horrible.
And it's just accepted. I mean, obviously there's people that will go on and write back to them or whatever, but they think that that's okay.
If my kids did that, they would be in trouble.
Big trouble.
There's no way.
Ivy gets in big trouble if
but
she
that's
talks
a lack
bad
of parenting
about
once
anybody.
Again, you know?
Yeah. I tell her, if you say bad things about other people, you're going to have to go and apologize to them. And I'm going to walk you right over there at 15 years old, and you're going to have to apologize for making that person cry because you decided to make fun of somebody. I said, that's absolutely not okay.
Yeah.
Empathy and compassion is the code that we're going to live by. And I don't care what your friends are doing.
I was talking, my boxing coach was asking me if I wanted my daughter to be an athlete because I told him that I put my boxing gloves on her and that I was showing her how to box. And I said, you know what? I don't really care. I mean, if she wants to be an athlete, great. If she doesn't, fine. If she wants to be a violinist, fine. I honestly don't care what my daughter does or wants to be. She can't be mean.
That's like the I don't care. I don't care if my daughter's a bad student. I don't care if my daughter is, I mean, I want her to be a good student. I don't really care. I don't care. I just I want her to not be mean. That's all I that's the only thing in my mind. I was like, I just don't want if Magnolia came home in 15 years and she's like, I have an F in biology, I'd be like, I'm not happy with you in any way. But it wouldn't ruin my day. If Magnolia came home with a letter from the principal saying that she was suspended because she called another girl a fat bitch, I would be mortified to think that like my daughter's a mean girl, you know?
Right. But I think the structure of the parenting in the home is like how I interact with her, how I interact with people around me, that tells my daughter what is and is not okay. And so my behavior and the modeling is so important, is that she's no longer listening to my words. She is watching what I do. And so I have to be what I want to instill in her. I have to be that. And so that's where they are now with these kids. They have all this media and all this exposure and all this nonsense. I mean, complete nonsense. I don't sit on the computer. I just don't get the whole computer thing. But she's on Snapchat. She's on this. She's on that. She's seeing stuff. And I said, you need to take a break from that. That's not real.
Yeah, it's a lot more.
Your neighbor is real. The kid down the street is real. Go talk to people. Don't sit behind this screen and be a facade. Be who you really are. And that's what I try to get instilled in these young girls, is that this is fantasy. None of this is real.
Yeah, I was lucky because my kids were all in college before the real internet revolution.
It's a real struggle.
But, you know, I did also teach them that when people are mean to you, definitely have a good comeback. And they're all really good at that now. So
okay,
I was thinking about how Drew and I notice it so much on Loveline, is that it's definitely already affected people's ability to communicate.
Yes, 100%.
I'm a dumbass, but since I was a little boy, if I wanted to go buy a CD, if I wanted a cassette, I had to walk out of my house or get my grandma to take me and deal with a human being and say that I would like to purchase this.
We went to the record store and we would just look through records, and it was like a social thing to do.
And if I wanted to talk to my teacher about not understanding something, I would have to wait after class and walk up to he or she and say, hello, Mr. McHale, I don't understand, and interact. And we're divorced of that now, especially at, you know, a young kid's age. Because everything they purchase, everything they interact with is all digital, and their ability to understand inflection, subtext,
subtle nuances,
and also just the ability to put together the language,
yes,
even for kids that are good students. Like, I'm shocked, like constantly shocked at how poorly people communicate. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, getting back to what you're talking about, how that they want to live in fantasy, that's, I think, the number one reason why we have, and just in the last like year, not in 2016, in the last 12 months, Drew and I have seen a massive increase of guys, 20, 21-year-old guys calling up as stalkers. They're like, well, my girlfriend broke up with me. What do I do? She has to be mine. And you go, listen, she doesn't want to be with you. What can I do now? She said she doesn't want to talk to me and we've been broken up for 6 months. What do I do? I go, what do you do? Find another girl. What do you mean?
We have two versions of it. One is that version where they can't deal with the breakup and they're just like, well, we got to fix this. And the other is they didn't have a relationship in the first place. The girl wasn't into it. So he settled for friend, puts in a couple years as the friend and goes, calls us and goes, now it's time. It's time.
And
that's
so
another stalking.
That's fantasy. When fantasy bleeds away and you're confronted with that reality and they have no ability to prepare for it, you know?
But I think that's also because people don't have lives anymore. People, any free millisecond of a day is spent scanning this phone and looking at things on the internet, and you don't have to have a life that interacts with anyone else to be able to enjoy entertainment, to be able to shop, to be able to do everything that you could never leave your couch and live.
Right.
Essentially.
Which is odd.
It's very odd.
Because the human being needs interaction. That's what we need. We have to have it.
Even for stupid stuff. You know, I was thinking about the other night when I saw that Blockbuster officially is done. It's like no longer a thing. Mm-hmm. Not even online presence. The whole, and I was thinking about Blockbuster.
And I thought about all the great movies I watched solely because I walked into the Blockbuster without an idea of what I was going to rent. Mm-hmm. And so you walk around and you like talk to the guy behind the counter or the girl. And it was an experience. And I watched.
Now you read the reviews and right. click now through
like,
on previews.
It's like, when, does that, when is that on video on demand? God. Oh, my God. 4 more days before I can get it on iTunes. You know, there's no kind of fork. You're not forced to kind of branch out.
You guys, we got to wrap mm-hmm. this up. Shelly, thank you for filling in for Bob.
Thank you.
So
thank
great
you.
To
Anytime.
See you.
Anytime.
Really?
So good to see you. Anytime. Absolutely.
Bring
callers. Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. We'll do one. We're going to do one coming up. We take callers.
So
bring
great.
Ivy.
Whatever
hang out
you
with us, too.
Do. I asked her to come today, but she's 15.
So just bring poison ivy then. Just
bring
literally.
Wah, ivy. Wah. Okay.
Spread it all over the place.
And then, you guys, thanks for being here. Next time.
Our pleasure.
We'll chronicle the development of your parenting experience.
Yeah. Yeah,
maybe next time we'll do it, we'll bring Magnolia.
I think
we'll see the
Magnolia can tell us all about it.
And you need to have another kid too. I'm just convinced of that. You get real sure. parenting. Enter sure. real
yeah,
parenting.
I am only yeah. I'm only a half a parent because I only have one child.
That's not true.
I told Bianca, I was like, let the animated show roll out. And if I'm the next Mike Judge, let's have as many kids as you want.
There but you go.
If not, then...
Well, I'm getting up there. I mean, I don't think we can pop out too many more.
Yeah, it's true.
You never know. That Czech blood.
And we can always adopt.
Right.
I've told
that's
you that.
Really
that's
good.
Right. What's your heritage?
English, Irish, Dutch.
Icelandic? Is that you too? Or is
Scottish.
That your husband?
No, that's Ivy's. Ivy's dad is like half Icelandic.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
is
that's
he, is he one of the world's strongest men?
No, he is. He's actually, but he is a Viking. He's extremely stubborn.
Yeah,
yeah.
This is all that Scotland, Ireland, mm-hmm. Denmark. Mm-hmm. It's all Viking blood that she's
yes,
got.
It
this
was
one's
all
got,
that's
pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Please, before we wrap up, check out our sponsors. Of course, if you have need for them, email us at the drdrew.com website. If you wanted to ask questions, we will try to take them on the show, and we will do calls too. If you want to be able to call in, you send us what it is you want to call about there. DrDrew.com/contact. And please join the email list. Sign up for the email list there. And as I said, support by clicking through on the Amazon banner on the site at DrDrew.com. We can be found on Twitter at This Life Podcast and at Dr. Drew. Check that out. Oh, and don't forget the Adam and Dr. Drew podcast and the Dr. Drew podcast as well. And Bob and I will look forward to bringing you more. And if you have suggestions for celebrities or people you want to hear here, please... do let us know again at the email list and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes to get it before anybody else. And if you like it, tell a friend.
Yes.
There
yeehaw.
You go. And that about what's okay.
Oh, I'm just giving you a thumbs up.
Thank you. Thank you.
Nailed it.
All right, you guys. We'll see you next time.
See ya.
swim on and I'll